All right. Thank you very much. Let's get to it.
Okay. Laura was actually mistaken. The John Looney who is speaking today is actually a different John Looney. I am a distinguished engineer, SRE, with Hooli. I spent a few years with Weyland Yutani Enterprises, a startup doing some space exploration, robotics stuff. I concurrently hold positions with as SVP of Thoughts with Omni Computer Products, also sideline of reliability. We had like one outage, wasn't it?
Only one. That's fine. That's 99-something.
Yeah, and most people survived. It's fine. I'm also working on the Board of Ethics with Cyberdyne Systems, an AI company, very promising.
It's an interesting scheduling problem, sort of a human Kubernetes, if you will.
Exactly. Thank you.
And I'm Corey Quinn. The entire reason I'm here is because John is brilliant. So brilliant, in fact, that I have to dumb down everything he says so the rest of you have a hope of understanding it. That's the beautiful part about being a translator. It's all on him. So now, John, please, fill and overfill us with your wisdom.
Thank you. Okay, so, SRE. What is SRE? At the core, SRE is about bringing engineering principles to operations, but more importantly, we are better than DevOps. DevOps are developers who are pretending to be SREs. And because they have a foot in both camps, they can't, you know, they'll get distracted by working on products, working on features, when they really should be focusing on the number one thing, which is reliability.
8% of the world can reasonably disambiguate between what an SRE is and what a DevOp is. The remaining 92% could not possibly care less. But the important thing is that we have nomenclature to argue about.
SREs enjoy outages. They thrive at them. SREs, a good SRE is an adrenaline junkie. We are at our best when we are in front of the whole company saying, it's cool, we've got this, and speaking with a calm voice, ensuring that incident management is done properly. We train for it all of the time.
Hiring is hard. You generally want to hire an SRE with a resting heart rate of around 220 beats per minute. Some people object in the interview process when you try and measure this directly, so you can test it indirectly. Midway through a conversation, throw a cup of coffee at them. If they catch it and all of the liquid, that's an A player.
We all love blameless postmortems. They're a very important part of our SRE culture. We spend a lot of time and effort writing a postmortem that can prove that it was not SRE's fault that the outage happened.
In many workplaces, you can't be aggressive, so you have to be passive aggressive. The purpose of a blameless postmortem is to really bring to light what we already knew. It's the application developer's fault. If you can frame it just right, they'll know exactly whose fault it is, and you don't have to say it out loud.
Chaos engineering is the discipline that you can apply to a production environment that is too stable, suspiciously so. If your hardware is working fine and your software is working fine, the application is good, why not break random shit? See what happens, see what breaks. And the best thing is, because you intentionally did it, because you are chaos engineering, it's not your fault.
The emerging field of chaos engineering is a wonderful marketing story. It turned the reason we fired Taylor into a career trajectory that has no upper bound. If a system seems suspiciously stable, go ahead and break it intentionally. If you can do that, it's obviously the application developer's fault. So throw them right under that bus.
We love dashboards. Dashboards are full of information. If you can build your dashboard so colorful, with so many graphs, you can prove any correlation caused exactly what you want the reader to believe. No executive is immune to their beauty.
If you fill your dashboards with enough minutia, eventually one of your C-level executives will snap and throw you through a single pane of glass.
Of course, we must remember what our greatest asset is. It is the technology that we build and gift to humanity. Some people say that disruption can be bad for some parts of society, but they're missing the point. That is, technology in its purest form, this wonderful, confusing asset of humanity, this can be used to generate lots of money.
Some may claim that some of our technology exploits people. We say, who cares? Let's say that I want to go ahead and slap John right in his thought leadery face. But his beard is bristly and I am weak. I'm going to use TaskRabbit to go ahead and hire someone to slap him for me.
Two can play at that game. I can hire two people on TaskRabbit as bodyguards.
And now we're in an arms race. Back and forth we go, and eventually leveraging the TaskRabbit API. That's right. We are now raising an army via API, and we are launching it today as our new startup, Rabbit Punch.
It's Uber for mercenaries. And we will be using an ICO to monetize it. We're thinking of calling them beatdown coins. Of course, it doesn't matter what your company is, if you sell embroidered socks on the internet, you need to build your own bespoke container framework. It's not enough to use other people's infrastructure. It's probably not designed specifically for embroidered socks.
Etsy! Oh.
Too soon.
Thank you.
You, and every one of you, is a beautiful and unique snowflake. No vendor can possibly understand the complexity of your product. No vendor understands exactly the way that your team enjoys writing up dashboards or doesn't understand how your escalation models internally work. They don't even understand that you like using INI files for configuration.
Engineers who work for vendors are crappy. Because if they were good, they would work for your company instead. Therefore, there's no reason in the world you should trust anything a vendor makes. Build your own.
Running infrastructure is absolutely your core competency. Therefore, whatever company you're in, make that your company's core competency. If you start work at a sock vendor, for instance, yes. Convince them that they need their own container orchestration framework, then their own storage engine, then their own database. And pretty soon, you'll be a VP of infrastructure at a SOC company.
You can't very well be an empire builder without an empire, now can you? Mm. If you wanted to wrangle a bunch of cloud services, that's not a VP of thoughts. That's a mid-level accounting job. You don't want that. You want the VP title, like me.
Of course, we only need a Bay Area office, because that's where the best engineers in the world go. If you're not in the Bay Area, let's face it, you're at best a B player. If you're not willing to uproot your life, leave your family, live in a shoebox, you're not able to show real commitment to a company.
Technology as an industry is so disruptive that we have taken a job that can be done from literally anywhere on the planet and caused a land crunch in 8 square miles located in an earthquake zone. John is hiring. Must be willing to relocate to the Bay Area.
It's important to make sure that everyone can give 100% all of the time. You should have a performance system that can give critical feedback whenever you feel people are slipping in a judgment-free context. So you can tell people, I don't think you're able You know, so maybe something happened in your life. We don't need to know the details, but I think you need to move on now.
It's important that you learn to hide your snicker when you use the phrase work-life balance. You tell people that it's okay to have take time off. Then you identify a random person and capriciously fire them out of the blue for not pulling their own weight, as an example to the rest. People work best when they're terrified that today might be their last.
Yeah, if people aren't terrified, they're going to get complacent and lazy. Our ideas are our legacy, our gift to humanity. In fact, one of the most important ways that you can measure your worth to society is by being invited to give keynotes at events like this.
The only business metric that matters is how many keynotes you're invited to give. It doesn't matter how well it maps to the audience's problems. You describe it aspirationally, you're incredibly vague, to the point where no one could actually implement what you suggest. And when they come back and say it didn't work, you can blame them.
They didn't do it properly. They didn't do it hard enough.
That's our talk!
Maybe
now,
not.
That was all well and good. But the point is don't be John. No one wants to be John. Who's John?
In real life, I'm a production engineer at Facebook, looking after host provisioning with the infrastructure team they have in Dublin. I used to work in Intercom for a bit, and then spent over a decade in Google SRE. Helped with some of the SRE books, and I'm on the steering committee for SRECon. So it's my fourth year here.
And I'm Corey Quinn. I'm a cloud economist, two words no one can accurately define, so no one calls me on it. In practice, I fix the horrifying AWS bill, but that leads to either no one wanting to talk about it or endless streams of profanity. What people tend to know me a bit better for these days is a newsletter, Last Week in AWS, where I gather all the news from Amazon's cloud ecosystem, strip out the parts that don't matter, and make fun of what's left. I also host the Screaming in the Cloud podcast every week, which several of you have been on already, thank you, and several more of you will be, though you may not know it yet. This seems like an opportune time to pivot to talking about the indigenous peoples of the Pacific Islands. More directly, during World War II. This was a relatively pastoral existence by a perspective of industrialized modern society, when you have the largest armies the planet has ever seen suddenly showing up in places they'd never been before. You wound up with effectively islands that had no real industrialized presence, suddenly home of supply depots, airstrips, all within a matter of days. And this was disturbing and shocking to some of the people who, you know, lived there already. So they looked at this and they saw that these airports would be built up almost instantaneously, and suddenly all this bounty from the skies shows up. So they did what many of us would do in a similar circumstance. They went on Hacker News and tried to build everything themselves from first principles. And, okay, this is not a terrible direction to go in as a first pass. It's, okay, we see airports and supply depots spun up. Okay, maybe there's a causal relationship here. So they went and they started building out mock airfields, waiting for a bounty to show up. It didn't happen. This is known as a term cargo cult, which can be used in a relatively problematic way, and I'm hoping I didn't wind up doing that here, because these people were not stupid. They had culture of their own. This turned into a very interesting moment for them, where suddenly everything that they had known about life was turned on its head. They wound up approaching this from a different point of view. What is it that they miss in those moments, and how does that map back to conferences like this? The answer that we think we found is context.
Like anyone who talks about blockchain, it's something similar. They say, but this company made loads of money with this initial coin offering, therefore I need to do this too, and it will make me loads of money. This is absolute, to me, an absolute example of this cargo culting. So when we talk about you need extra context, you see a great idea, and you try and work out, is this applicable to my team, my company at all? If it is, what do I need to change? How do I know that we're doing it wrong? And think of all of these things before just blindly copying it.
Gathering context is an interesting challenge. How do you get appropriate context to make sure that you're making decisions that are right? There are a few answers for this. For example, you wind up with things like the Forrester Wave, the Gartner Magic Quadrant, other companies and shapes that wind up effectively building out a reasonable model of the industry that they're focusing on. They have NDA'd conversations with clients, with vendors, and start to get a strategic picture for the landscape. It's not a terrible model. If you don't enjoy paying enormous piles of money for reports, things like the ThoughtWorks Technology Radar winds up doing something very similar on a quarterly basis. And it gives you at least some general idea of what the, I guess, industry zeitgeist is. Is this something that people are investing in? Is this something that we should be looking at? Or is it something we should get up on stage and make fun of? It really tends to vary.
Yeah, like blockchain.
Exactly.
Okay, so for instance, we use these models to work out what talks we should accept for SREcon.
It's why 3/4 of the conference budget went to Gartner. Oops.
Totally worth it. Totally worth it.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I'm going to use an industry standard meme maturity models, try and show it how it could be applied to SREcon, but I want you all the time think, how could this apply to my organization? What context am I missing that makes this seem like a better idea than it is, or a worse idea than it is?
Right, and what's interesting about this model is that Martin Fowler, who's famous for giving quotes that wind up on slides in keynote talks, mentions that the value of a maturity model assessment is not to figure out exactly where you are, but it gives you an idea of where you need to go to next. One of his diagrams winds up specifically pointing out that if you look at it as a ladder, you can't skip steps. Figuring out what to work on next is a very valuable thing. Otherwise, it feels like you have to work on everything, and you lose velocity surely through lack of focus.
Hmm. So this is a really, really simple graph. You can imagine you ask some random team, where do you think you are with your process and tools? Get them to put a mark on a graph. Doesn't matter. You notice there's no axes here, right? Because axes are cheating. We just want like a gut feeling. But if you ask them to contact their stakeholders, teams they work with, their peers, and discuss it, they'll often end up with a different idea. In this case, yeah, it turns out we updated it after chatting to people. We're a lot less better than we thought we were. But now we know this, and they know this, and we can move on.
And it builds shared context, which is important. You can also then use this to wind up tracking progress. For example, here's where we are today. Here's where we hope to be in a couple of quarters. But ultimately, this is where we want to be at the end. You'll notice that their target is not perfect on either axis, let alone both. They're still in the good part of the magic quadrant. But they don't need to be best of industry on this particular metric, whatever it is they're evaluating.
Yeah, I've worked at teams doing maturity models where they have, 75 questions you ask, and then you work at how many points you are, and they'll have, the little markings there. These are usually nonsense. Make work exercises by project managers who want to confuse people. I'd much prefer things like this, which have no axes, and you just like go, there.
Because you could also throw darts.
Actually measuring isn't actually that useful. Just go have the conversations with people. And another example would be, the target there. This is telling people, we're going to work more on process and tools. That's it. When I left Google after over a decade and ended up in Intercom, one of my coworkers turned around to me and said, the Greek's way of getting fired here is try and learn everything, or try and apply everything you learned in Google. And I was like, no. We worked with really smart people. They wouldn't have taught me anything that was not applicable here. It took me, I'm going to say, about 3 months to go, whoa, you're actually serious. You would much rather ship a new product and get more money in the door than maintain 5 nines of uptime. And they were like, yeah, we're not profitable yet. We're slowly running out of business, of course.
If your business plan is step one, raise a $20 billion seed round to spend on building your own global 8 nines of resilience architecture, maybe don't.
Unless you're Uber.
Well, Uber's a whole separate kettle of wax.
Yeah. Okay, so another useful thing for these kind of metrics is to collect them from multiple teams and maybe have the senior technical leadership look over them. In this one, we can see Team B are obviously awesome, and A, C, and E, maybe we should consider firing them.
The challenge here is understand, in a vacuum, something like this isn't actionable. It's a data point. It's nothing more. Perhaps Team B winds up not having to labor under certain business constraints that other groups do. Maybe they're overstaffed. Maybe they wound up solving a way through the organizational quagmire that works for them. Maybe they should start talking to other teams about what they're doing and starting to socialize that back into the environment.
Yeah, maybe they're turd polishing. So this is a phrase of, you know, you've got this system. It doesn't actually need to be reliable, but it's really easy to make it very reliable. So spend extra time on the thing that's really easy to make it up and to the right. Let's ignore the fact that our other service, the Team A, is this giant data warehouse that's vital to the company, and it's a complete shit show because we took it in through an acquisition. So,
and you didn't track where they started. So yes, we have a data lake now, but 6 months ago it was a data swamp. We're improving.
Okay.
We should warn you. There are a lot of words on the next slides. This is to give you a general idea. Don't feel the need to read every word.
Myself and Corey both have a rule that once you go over about 5 words in a slide, it's not cool. But
you can read or you can listen. We suggest listening.
Yeah. Okay, so you can imagine you're going to engaging with an SRE team and you want to start a conversation around their SLOs. Everyone loves service level objectives. Why? Because it helps people explain what their service is supposed to do to their stakeholders, and then their stakeholders can go, that's not what it was supposed to do, or possibly even agree. There is going to be an overall maturity path as you get better SLOs. It's completely up to your organization which ones to do. These ones were ones I built for another company in a different time. But they're still useful for kind of guessing where do we need to be, where are we going to go.
And in many cases, the process of figuring out what those SLA looks like as the negotiation with the business grows is more valuable than the SLO itself. It's the shared understanding it gives rise to.
Absolutely. Okay. Capacity planning is also something SREs are supposed to be good at.
Spoiler, nobody's good at it.
Yeah. I'll call out one of the things here. Executing a plan for 10x load. Like, you know, have an outline plan for what do we need if we're going to have 10x load. Sounds reasonable, right? Well, what if you're WhatsApp and you already have 2 billion users? Do you really want an operational plan for 20 billion users?
We're going to need a couple extra planets at least, like 3.
Okay, so in anything, even when it does look good, you're still going to have to tailor it for your own team, and that's pretty cool. So if someone comes to you with, a capacity plan, or sorry, a maturity model, don't take it off them without serious tailoring. And if they try and sell it to you as a one-size-fits-all, you'll know that something has gone horribly wrong.
Absolutely. Okay. It's also handy to remember that scaling is going to be very different for different companies. If you're a web-scale company where everything happens in the terms of tens of millions of users, that's one end of the spectrum, and that's where a lot of SRE discipline and doctrine comes out of. But there are B2B companies that wind up onboarding a new customer over an 18-month span. Being able to go from 10 to 100 or 1,000 of customers overnight, there is no value to that business in being able to scale that rapidly.
There's going to be lots of talks this week on operation maturity. Everyone has their red button items. For me, I hate graphs that don't have a red line. Like if I see things going up and down and I have no idea if the up is bad or down is bad, that sort of stuff really annoys me. Your team, your organization can get together with the senior technical people and go, yeah, what do we actually care about in this organization? Do we care? Maybe we only get one page a month, so who cares if it we don't have inhibits, and that one page a month can be 7 pages because multiple things go down. But again, you should have that conversation. Say, what is operationally mature? What teams do we have in our org that aren't need help, basically, to be brought up to the standard?
Ask them what ticks them off the most, and then immediately dive for cover because you're about to get an earful. For me, it's dashboards that display things that are not actionable or that I don't have any real business need to know. CloudWatch, I am absolutely looking at you. If it's not actionable, get it out of my way. But everyone's going to have something in that list that annoys the heck out of them, and figuring out what the shared perspective on that is provides a great framework that people can get behind rather than, well, the book says we should care about. That doesn't win hearts and minds. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Lastly, performance maturity is something that very few teams know about. I mentioned here, or is it on the stable? I'm going to say, the cost per query. So I used to run an installers team, and somebody asked me at one point, can we, you know, reinstall machines every month just in case they've been compromised or there's integrity problems? I was like, I don't know. Work it out, clickety-click. Okay, it costs about 4 cents to install a machine. When you have the installers that we have, the staff on hand, and a bunch of other bits and pieces, it's like, that's nothing. Yeah, we can absolutely pay for all the machines to be reinstalled. But most people have no idea what their cost per QPS or cost per million QPS served is. Without that idea of, like, well, what does it actually cost us to do something? It's very hard to find, work out, is it worth spending team time improving? So the performance maturity model, also applies to some of the work you do, right?
As someone who spends their life dealing with the business implications of the AWS bill, one of the most commonly believed fictions in many companies is that they know what it costs to provide their service. Turns out when you start scratching below the surface, well, someone told us something 4 years ago that we sort of took as gospel, and we've been representing that in our public filings. Whoops. It winds up being something that can be overlooked, and digging into the assumptions that form these things are important. Understanding where you are and how you got there as far as determining what your performance is critical.
A perfect example of this is on performance maturity. The team I was working with mentioned that they needed to work out how to shard MySQL, and I was like, I didn't know you had a database. It turns out they were using MySQL as a locking mechanism, so they had lots of machines or something like that, and they basically wanted to use it for locking purposes. And using a database for distributed lock, like, yeah, it works for a small number. But when you're having hundreds of thousands of transactions per minute, it turns out it was just falling. So they said, we just need like 1,000 MySQL hosts. And it was like, you're all mad.
Anything's a distributed lock if you hold it wrong.
Yeah, that's true. The dining philosopher's algorithm, don't use MySQL databases, use forks. Okay, data maturity. One of the great things about this is that we have the GDPR now, which means nobody is in the chaotic state anymore. Right?
Whose company is fully GDPR compliant right now? Okay, I see a couple of hands here. Is anyone willing to bet 5 years in prison that they're right? Oh, look, I see only a couple of hands of people who weren't paying attention. Oh, I was staring at my phone. I should stick a hand up there. Exactly. The next talk is going to be specifically about that, so you need not belabor that overly.
Yeah, let's not. Okay, next.
Of course.
Okay, do not be afraid to ask for help. Getting context is going to be the most important thing you're going to do when you're trying to work out how you can improve your SRE team. It can be really useful to go to conferences like this, meet random people, get in those conversations. And if you have, you know, niggling doubts on architectures, if you have process problems, it's a safe place to admit failure. For instance, we didn't kind of
touch
on this.
And eventually, if at some point you get past the point where talking to your peers winds up not working out, there is no shame in bringing in an outsider who's seen that before.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You can even hire a consultant.
Or two. And lastly, alternately, if this fails, you could always do what a lot of companies do and rip off Netflix's culture deck. For those who aren't aware, this is on SlideShare. Mm-hmm. It's a list of the principles that shape Netflix's culture. Things such as, we only hire senior engineers. We wind up, which everyone claims to wind up following. We give all of our developers access to root and production, some banks start trying to follow and don't work. And they mentioned that they pay absolute top of market, which absolutely nobody else tries to emulate. And then at the end, people say, well, we borrowed these concepts. Why aren't we feeling success? And the piece of context that they miss is that, remember, you aren't Netflix. What works for the streaming movie service doesn't work for a credit union.
Yeah. Like, if you're a bank, you're not serving movies, and it turns out that when you go down for a while, people actually care when they can't get their paychecks out, rather than just watch something
else. Some people have that reversed, but, you know, it takes what you can get. If nothing else that you take away from this talk, the point that we want to convey is to find what works for you. Because someone winding up putting things into a conference talk and saying it on stage doesn't make it true. Who here has tried to build something and failed miserably? How many of you people submitted a story about that to SREcon? Okay. We'd like to see a lot more talks like that, because you learn more from companies' failures than you do from their successes.
And actually, if you're going to submit talks in future, put more in about not just, don't focus on what went well. Try and work, give the audience context on how did you realize this is going to be a good solution? Were there solutions that you discarded halfway through that looking back is complete nonsense, but at some point you thought it made sense? Because let's face it, we don't make mistakes intentionally.
X was a wrong decision. That's great. How did you make that decision? That's the story that doesn't get told enough. Okay, the real is our talk. John, you're giving a workshop on Friday about what?
Distributed systems building blocks. So how to choose the right database for the right purpose.
Yes, as a lock. Whereas I'm giving a talk that afternoon on the myth of cloud agnosticism, which is just guaranteed to be an absolute laugh riot. Thank you all.
Good luck.